Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Navigating the Hurdles of DL-178C Development. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems Magazine and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Vance Hilderman, Director of Global Services for Vector Software, and Gary Gilliland, Technical Marketing Manager for DDCI Incorporated. Now for some short housekeeping announcements. This eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Well, I also want to point out three important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. The second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The third button on your console window allows you to enter questions in real time. We will do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event. And now I'm pleased to turn over to our first speaker, Vance Hilderman of Vector Software. Vance?
Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. Welcome, everyone. Good morning, good evening, and good night. I'm Vance Hilderman from Vector Software, and today, with DDCI and Gary and team, we're going to talk about DL-178C, specifically how to make it easier and some best practices. And you know our webinars here. We like to start off with a little quiz. So how about this? Seven quick questions, true or false. DL-178C will improve the necessity of detailed requirements. True or false? Increase development costs 60% or more over CMMI level 3. Number 3, true or false? Simplify certification of configuration items or parameter data items. Number 4, allow specification and design in a single model. True or false? Number 5, simplify some level A testing. Number 6, mandate bottom to top traceability. True or false? And finally, number 7, reduce your avionics software certification costs. 7 questions, most of them may seem simple, but I assure you truly there are several tricky questions in there. We're going to discuss them, and in 20 minutes at the end of my presentation before turning it over to Gary and team, we'll go through the answers. With that, let's go to the next slide. Here, real quickly, Vector fits into the V model of software development. Specifically, the left side of the V in blue are the developmental stages of software, starting with coding, we've got design, integration, and systems. On the right-hand side, in red, is the Vector solutions for each. As you can see, Vector has full service, full lifecycle solutions in our products for unit testing, integration testing, the module testing, system testing, and with new tools, not just for level A through level D, but also through the entire lifecycle of aggregating test results, automating regression testing, implementing continuous-based testing, and soon in the cloud to automate all your testing across multiple processors. Let's dive in. Slide number 4, our professional services. We fit the bill on these activities that we just talked about. We do training, project consulting, best practice workshops, and we even do quite a variety of services for standard compliance and continuous test implementation, onshore or offshore. Now, slide number 5. Truly, DL-178C is not difficult. The title of today's webinar is Navigating the Hurdles. We all know in an Olympic race, when you see the Olympic athletes charging over those hurdles, they look so graceful. That's because, A, they're experienced, B, they have a lot of practice and a lot of skill. With experience, practice, and skill, we can navigate truly the hurdles of 178C because it can be simplified. There's essentially 71 key objectives for level A, slightly less for B, a little less for C and D. But by treating it as a ladder, think of those 71 key objectives as rungs on a ladder. If you try to skip several rungs, you better be incredibly athletic, like an Olympian, or a little lucky. Instead, we recommend relying upon skill and practice to go one rung at a time. Develop a big picture of 178C and truly climb one rung at a time. Let's see what that means. On slide number 6, please consider the avionics development ecosystem. This has always been in the background as a recommended practice. With 178C, it's now mandatory. The head of that system in red on the upper left is ARP 4761, soon to be ARP 4761A. It's in draft final form now, should be released before the end of the year. That will also become mandatory. Next comes the system development process, where 4761 defines the criticality level and the architectural inputs to system safety. System development is a process that parallels DO-178 and 254 because it uses the new standard 2 years ago, ARP 4754A, which is mandatory. It says we must develop a foundation for system safety and ongoing system process, just as we did for software. So those red hand-drawn little arrows are the feedback loops, everyone, that have to be shown, not just by formal process, but by actual activities, audit record, and QA results, that ecosystem, all four of those boxes, safety, system, software, hardware, are done continuously and to standards. Next, if we look at slide 7, let's consider, truly, we have that ecosystem that we just talked about. But also we've got DO-330 for tool qualification, DO-331, model-based development 332, object-oriented technology, and finally, DO-333, formal methods. These are part of the ecosystem, but those four supplements, DO-330 through 333, are not only just for software, they also apply to hardware, to ground-based systems, to integrated modular avionics. That's why they're separate broken out supplements to consider that whole ecosystem. So these are regulated by EASA in Europe, FAA in the U.S., in Canada, in Asia, many other countries. It covers the full engineering lifecycle, planning, configuration management, quality assurance, development, and verification. Remember, verification is not just testing. Verification is three things, reviews, tests, and what wasn't fully conclusively tested by combination of reviews and tests, additional analysis, and then development, but not just code development, it's requirements development, design, implementation, verification, and then quality assurance, liaison, and certification. The next slide, slide number 8, remember, we have to consider that full ecosystem, so the users must consider their safety ongoing. Every time there's a software a change, requirements, we have to consider, are there any derived requirements? And derived requirements come from the engineer. They're derived from an engineer's brain. They're not derived from a parent requirement necessarily. They're called derived requirements because they're derived by human knowledge. So we need to consider those interrelationships upon safety, upon system, and show that we truly do that throughout the complete development lifecycle. On slide number 9, remember, we have those three processes. Planning must come first, both at the systems level, safety level, and the software hardware level. For 178C, development follows, and then correctness isn't a sequential process. Rather, as you can see, that correctness process is fully ongoing in the background, continuously. Okay? Next slide. We can see slide number 10, an optimal path. Now, this is not EASA approved, FAA approved, CAA approved, so I put my name on this. You can blame me if you want. 178C does not prescribe a particular recipe. It's flexible to accommodate multiple different viewpoints, and we'll see that in just a few minutes, specifically on modeling, for example. But here's the overall ecosystem of 178C, what I believe, and we at Vector practice, as an optimal DO-178C path. In the upper left, we start with the system safety assessment. Moving left to right, that's the planning process where we initiate quality assurance, system requirements, and look at the overlap and lack of overlap. QA must be fully in place before we take formal credit for those systems requirements. Why? QA has to review those and audit those requirements. Then develop plans, checklists, traceability, implement the configuration management so we can track everything. And those four red circles with the yellow boxes are stage of involvement. SOI-1 says you have good plans. Just like building a house, your plans have been approved. You're now ready to break ground. Well, in software, breaking ground starts with high-level requirements. Look at the overlap. Low-level requirements. That's right. Those overlap. It's not a perfect waterfall. Okay? We are allowed to iterate and have parallel activities, and we do so with 178C, in particular with model-based development and OO, that's accentuated. Then we have design, and 178 does not give us a clear black and white boundary. We all love boundaries, but unfortunately, they're not specifically in 178C. Fortunately, that means 178C wants us to define our own boundaries, so it's incumbent, required upon us, the developers, to develop those boundaries between high-level, low-level design. Then we implement our code, same for hardware logic, complex electronics hardware. Then we do verification and validations done at the system level, and SOI-2, SOI-3. And do you ever have changes on your project? Of course you do. Real life does have changes. The last stage, SOI-4, our conformity review, do those changes, do all of the artifacts conform to the very beginning plans defined in SOI-1? At that stage, we're ready for flight test. Can we have open problem reports when we fly the aircraft? Yes, as long as they're identified. So that was an optimal path. Now let's look at some specifics with 178C. Many of us increasingly use modeling for complex software. We get tremendous benefit on reusability, perhaps automatic code generation. Modeling really is the future, especially for complex systems. It improves software schedule quality. But there's some issues, okay? There's no free lunch. Potentially, modeling has a challenge in that it really obfuscates, makes oblique the traceability issues. So go ahead and adopt modeling and automated code generation. Specify the modeling traceability, how you will trace your models from the human requirement. Remember, models always have to start with the human. Anything the human does has to be verified. Verified means reviews, tests, and potentially additional analysis. So formalize that modeling and traceability review and usage within the verification. Make sure you don't lose traceability as you progress through the design model specification model stage. Number 12, specifically 178C, we call it the ice cream store. We get to choose not just vanilla, but four other flavors of modeling. Now, these five particular flavors, just like an ice cream store with five flavors, means there's something for everyone. 178C, the beauty is that it's flexible. It doesn't tie us to a particular modeling approach. There's five different approaches, MB1, 2, 3, 4, 5. As you can see, we get to choose where to put the boundary between system requirements, high level, low level, and implementation. Specifically, the specification model, the higher level, the design model. Now, if you're new to modeling, perhaps you would not generate code. Perhaps if your system engineers are traditional and want to work in English, then you choose a modeling approach that allows system engineering to work in English. But folks, the future, the best practice is to have a common language. The number one cause of avionics software errors is requirements. One of the biggest challenges with requirements is different people with different languages. An English language system engineer versus a high-order SysML, UML, C++ software engineer. Better to speak one language, and that language is the model. On the next slide, slide number 13, we can see the modeling tips. You always have to have requirements, okay? All models have to have requirements. Why? Because model has to be reviewed. Anything the human does isn't trusted. Guilty until proven innocent, the human activity must be verified. How do we verify? We compare it to what was expected versus what we got. Therefore, what was expected is the requirements. The model can be either a specification model or a design model, but not both. Models must have standards. spec model standard, design model standard. They must be different. They must be codified or written. Next, software requirement. 178C says accidental coverage, assumptions of low-level design, low-level requirements is not allowed. Software requirements really are the success foundation. We need to show that, in fact, we have a process whereby we have detailed requirements so that we don't make assumptions. Many 178B users took shortcuts. They failed to fully specify low-level requirements, and they filled in the gaps by just accidental structural coverage. In 178C, ask yourself five key questions. Are the requirements fully testable? Could a test engineer write test cases? Are they deterministic? Would the same result happen and the same reviewer make the same assessment every time? Does testing rely upon assumptions? Might two different developers implement that software differently based on requirements? Finally, if you cannot unambiguously determine the expected input, how could a developer? So we must improve those requirements first by avoiding assumptions. Next, we need to promote path coverage. 170C says not accidental coverage, not just setting the program counter, but requirements need to be the basis of structural coverage. So assess requirement quality by correlating to structural coverage. You see, 178C doesn't have strict requirements for how good to make your requirements. How does it assess then how good those requirements are? By testing those requirements, did you achieve approximately, no black and white, approximately 90% or more decision condition coverage? Did you cover all the branches just by writing good tests to good requirements? If you didn't, then one of two problems exists. Your requirements were weak or your tests were weak. Next, we can see that parameters are treated as regular items. Okay? We need to do these tests, and hopefully these tests use great world-class tools like VectorCast, our company's tools for structural coverage, requirements-based testing, integration testing. We have to include the parameters. In 178B, a lot of liberties were taken, but 178C says parameter data items, PDIs, those configuration items, need to be treated just like regular embedded logic. Full application of 178C, requirements, reviews, traceability, and tests. Slide 17, there's no free lunch. 178C, just as 178B, added costs. There's no doubt. Well, if CMM Level 3 is truly good quality, and it is, true Level 3, why does it cost more with 178C? Well, remember, 178C has these differences over CMMI Level 3. Continuous safety and systems feedback, remember the ecosystem, ARP 4761 and 4754A, continuous. You must perform detailed reviews of designs and tests, bottom to top traceability, proving not just that you implemented all the requirements, but that you only implemented the requirements. There's no extra dead code. Number D, more thorough QA audits plus those SOIs. For level C, B, and A respectively, statement coverage, decision condition coverage, MCDC structural coverage, tested hopefully with good tools like VectorCast products. F, there's a need for far higher certifiable components, okay? They need to be much higher quality. We have to show that all those components meet all 71 objectives in the case of level A, and truly guilty until proven innocent. So 178C is never cheap, but it can be cost effective. On slide 18, 178C does add some additional level A verification. Source to binary is explicitly required for level A. We must prove that all types, all data types, not every line of code, but every type of code, every operator with all possible types that can happen at runtime are correlated via a manual review or an automated review with a proven qualified tool. Source to binary does not apply to the deactivated code or the conditionally compiled code. So remember, save yourself time if you have deactivated code, modules that aren't referenced and a smart linker excludes, or conditional compilation that's not an executable. Don't bother with those. You'd no requirement for that. So specify those details of how you do that in your software verification plan. Slide 19, back to that quiz. Okay, how'd you do? Number one, 178C will improve the necessity of detailed requirements. Yes, yes indeed. Remember, you need detailed requirements for all your low-level logic decisions. It will increase development costs. No, not 60% over CMM level 3. The true answer is 30 to 35% for the reasons we just gave 4 minutes ago. Number three, it's false that 170C will simplify certification of configuration items. Quite the opposite. You must treat them as actual software. Number four, you cannot have the specification and design in one model. Well, technically you can. In many industries, telecom, you absolutely do that. Not in avionics. We want a two-step approach. Just like we had high-level then low-level requirements in the waterfall, now we have specification model and design model, sequential steps, each verified separately. Number five, true. 170C will simplify some level 8 testing, for example, masking. If a condition is masked, you don't have to verify it. Number six, 170C will mandate bottom-to-top traceability for level A and C. 170B recommended it. 170C mandates it. And finally, will 170C reduce your avionics development costs? Probably not, but it can be cost-effective, as we've shown. With that, I would now like to turn it back to John. Here, by the way, are our vector locations. Mr. McHale, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Vance. Another excellent presentation from you. And before I turn it over to the next speaker, I just want to encourage and remind the audience that once Gary is done speaking, we will start our Q&A session. So if you have questions for Vance or Gary, start getting them in now. And now it pleases me to turn it over to Gary Gilliland. Gary?
Thanks, John. I'm Gary Gilliland. I am a technical marketing manager for DDCI. I'd like to let you know that, you know, DDCI as a company only works in the avionics software market. That's our primary market. That's what we've been doing for years. And so this slide set is more towards the moving away from the, you know, what do you have to do setting up your avionics system for DO-178C and kind of moving into where tools affect your capability and ease of use and make it easy to develop. So if we look at basically what Vance has already said in a lot of these things, you know, developing 178C avionics software is significantly more effort than standard industry practices, and it has more requirements and traceability, and it's not typically what you see. I like to put up my little bug slide there. Not that avionics software doesn't have bugs, but it's tested to a much more extreme level, and those are resolved. Just a reminder of the software V model. When the VectorCast tools work a lot on in the whole V model, as an RTOS company, we focus, you know, our RTOS is developed to the software V model. We do all requirements-based testing, integration, we have all that. We also provide tools on the application side to facilitate the development and testing of the applications that you develop for the RTOS. And just like we were talking about, an RTOS goes through all these standard DO-178C processes as well. It is developed and verified to meet all the requirements that are put forward. So the planning process, development process, requirements, design, all the way down through QA, configuration management. So we talked a little bit about what does it take in the previous part of the presentation, but you know, when I worked for Honeywell Aerospace, we developed some metrics, and you know, we looked at the way software development was going, and we kind of came up with the idea that a software engineer could develop 4 lines of code a day. And you might, you know, initially think that seems absurd. How is that possible? But with the processes that you must follow and the things you must do, every line of code has tests. Every, you know, There's reviews. There's requirements for all those. So by the time he writes all these, does all this documentation, testing, that's it's a pretty significant effort that has to be put forth. So there are many tool vendors that have solutions that attempt to make this process easy. The RTOSes provide tools to provide the foundation for your development. Companies like VectorCast also provide the tools to help you do your requirements, do your testing. So the rest of this presentation is kind of focused on how can the RTOS vendor help? What do we as a company provide those for your solution, and really this is kind of where it comes down to. You want to select an RTOS vendor that helps you facilitate reduction of risk, schedule, and cost. And how is that done? Well, obviously, it needs to be a pedigree. It needs to have been done before. You need to provide a robust development environment. So tools basically, tools that can provide you the development, verification, certification processes, enable and help those. You would really like to have those tools increase your productivity. That's why you certainly don't want the RTOS tools to make your activities longer. And then you want unique architecture that optimizes resources. So how can an RTOS architecture help you, reduce RTOS overhead and those kind of things? So that's kind of the focus of the rest of the presentation. If we look at DEOS, for instance, it has all of this capability, but a whole lot more. There are several instances of RTOSes that have artifacts, but have not really been through certification. DEOS has been certified to DALE since 1998. It has a long service history, greater than 10,000 aircrafts flying with DEOS on it, millions of flight hours. So that fits one part of the puzzle that, hey, we're here, we've been here, done this, reduce risk. The idea of a robust development environment is, okay, so you have tools, you have training support, that's great, but can I use those tools all the way through the verification and validation process? Well, not if they get in the way of your timing of your system. If they're going to interfere, then that's not a problem. And then worst case analysis, which I'll talk about a little bit later too, is how do I get that? How do I understand that? If we look at productivity is good for one program. It's good for multiple programs. So how do I, you offer me reuse of software, but at the binary level, at the artifacts level, can I reuse all of that? DEOS has that capability. How do I configure my I/O and what's the differences there? And DEOS provides a great way to abstract I/O and configure that. And then resource utilization, there's a lot of key architectural things that provide ways to maximize CPU utilization. So we'll go a little further. So from the pedigree, I like to put up this slide because it kind of shows a single line of ongoing development for DEOS since 1998. I don't believe that's very common in the industry. Most of your COTS dealing with the operating systems don't have this. Plus, it's kind of interesting. We put up the DERs that we've worked with. So there's probably somebody on there somebody that your DER can talk to understand how DEOS works. It's easy to reduce risk and find ways to verify the pedigree. And then tools. I talked about this a little bit, but having industry standard tools is really key. Having Eclipse environment, you can find engineers all over the world that know how to use Eclipse IDEs. Having development tools that include target simulation. Simulation environments are great for your real custom hardware. And then verification tools. How do I have tools to help me with my verification process, with my testing, with my my analysis. How do I do that? So we have provide those, and then configuration tools, and we'll talk about those a little bit about how XML and having component level XML tools is very key. This is kind of an overview slide. I basically put it up because I really like that development environment there that guy has. Someday I'm going to build me a chair like that, I think. But the idea is that you have a nice cross-development environment that provides you everything you need in a fast, seamless integration so that you can, you know, upload, download files to your target, debug, transform data files, and all that good stuff. So it's a nice way to look at things. So profilers. Profilers are key as well to understanding how your system is responding. So you develop your applications, you want to know, you know, you did your analysis, you say, I need this much stack size, I need this much RAM size. Well, profilers can tell you exactly as the system is running, what is the maximum amount of RAM that I've used? How many semaphores did I get? Did I get everything right? You know, log any events or exceptions that occur. So, you know, the status monitor takes care of that, provides you, you know, real-time information on everything that's going on in the system, all the system resources that are involved in your applications. And then from a timing standpoint, is everything, you know, operating the way I thought? Is it executing in the order that I expect? Is it repeatable and all and that? So TimeMap provides you that GUI information as well as an XML dump, so you can have a normalized spreadsheet to compare that to over time as you're doing your development. Another one of the key tools that you need to have is a structural coverage tool. DDCI provides a structural coverage tool that's what we use to verify the kernel. Back when we were starting this in the 90s, you know, there wasn't this kind of information. So we built a tool that does that. We provide that to our customers, but we also work with VectorCast, their tools, and you can pick and choose, decide how you want to do your structural coverage analysis. And then, as I mentioned before as well, you need a simulation environment. So if you're like most programs, avionics hardware tends to be custom hardware. And so the software development starts way before the hardware is complete. So you need to provide, the RTOS companies provide a simulation platform that allows you to do functional testing and make sure the software is working as you expected. We provide a QEMU environment that's basically a virtual machine that runs, boots, and runs exact binaries so that you can test those functionally before you get your real hardware. And then the next thing that's really, really important is worst-case execution time. So, you know, it's one of the most critical system engineering issues is how do you know what that is? And typically it's a trial and error process. You can do analysis, but you know, the RTOS and the underlying hardware architecture has a lot of that, you know, detail and contributes a lot to what that is. And so, you know, most RTOS companies don't give you that kind of information, but it's very platform specific. There are, you know, RTOS, driver overheads, application execution time, cache effects. You know, one of the unique things about DIOS is it provides detailed information on the RTOS effects and that are happening during the execution of your system. So reports on all the critical timing. And then, you know, it's basically that critical timing is put in registry files, configuration files, so that you can see it, you can tweak it, you can review it. We also have a unique cache tracker technology that enables you to find out what the worst case execution time of your application is. Make it where it's always looking at dirty cache, and so it helps, you know, figuring out what the application execution period you add all that up and get the full worst-case execution. So this is just a list. I just want to throw this up. This is just some of the things that, you know, your RTOS company should be able to provide you in a run. You know, what's your thread scheduling, context switch times? What is your, you know, if your thread tries to exceed its budget, you know, how long does that take? What's the context switch take? Those kind of things. Pretty simple. Most people want to know this information. DOS kernel provides that information for you. And then integration. Integration is always one of those fun things. It's like, okay, I've got all these applications built. I want to integrate that. How do I know if my system's going to work together? The DOS integration tool is unique because every component of DOS, as well as the application, has an XML-based configuration file. The integration tool reads in all that information and determines if it's a valid system, if the resources are available to do what you're trying to do, if the time is available, time budgets are available, and if so, generates a registry file that, you know, is basically the personality of the system that you can configure, you know, and run the system. So when the kernel boots up, it reads this registry and it knows how everything works together. So it's a very powerful tool, and it gives you great information to determine, are you on the right path, are you doing the right thing? Now I'm going to get kind of into architecture and reuse. Reuse takes a lot of different cases in this world. A lot of times you're just looking at basic, you know, source code reuse. That's kind of the definition that most of the industry uses. But in reality, you really want to use the binaries over if you can. And the fact that they are parameterized through the configuration file means that you can actually take the binaries, the configuration file, and those artifacts and move those from system to system without ever having to rebuild them. You know, basically just have to retest them in the new environment, but not redo all the architecture and all the other processes that were done before. So it's a really good and powerful reuse model. But obviously, you know, one of the problems is the reality of reuse is that I/O is always changing. Not only is it changing from program to program, a lot of times it changes during the program. So how do you manage that difficulty in those items? And basically, you want to try to isolate your software from this volatility. So DOS provides basically a data distribution capability. We call it I/O infrastructure. It isolates your I/O from the parameters, from the data types, and allows you to use this as a transport of data, but also can transform the data. So if you wanna, you know, for some programs you might produce data in mile per hour, some you might produce it in kilometers per hour. Sometimes you want to consume miles per hour. Sometimes you want to consume mock. So all that could be done in the actual data transport, and then it doesn't have to be focused in the applications. Therefore, those applications that are just gathering data and getting data can be the same, and, you know, facilitates reuse across the aircraft system. So the last section is about optimizing resources. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with architecture. What is the architecture of the RTOS that enables that capability? Obviously, for a IMA architecture for DO-178, you have to use the MMU in some shape or form. DOS takes full advantage of that. Paged model with the MMU keeps everything separate, including device drivers. But we also have some new, unique, flexible scheduling capabilities. We do 653 scheduling, we do RMA scheduling, we do Slack scheduling. Slack scheduling is very powerful. It allows you to take your unused worst-case budgeted time and use that for other tasks. So it enables you to make better utilization of your CPU. We also have the way we implement system timing is unique and different. Most RTOSes do it differently. We'll talk about that. And we also have memory pools and cache partitioning, which is a way to, in a single core system, to partition your cache and have applications just use particular parts of cache. In a multi-core system, even more powerful, where cores can be tied to specific partitions in a shared cache and not affect the other core's memory and cache. So it's a very powerful capability. Just a little bit on the system tick. If you're familiar with many RTOSes, the system tick is typically used as a resolution of all timers in the system. So if you have to do something really fast, then your system tick has to be really fast. And it's typically handled by an interrupt. So if you have a longer task, you're going to get multiple interrupts from the system tick while you're trying to execute your application. That can typically easily put in, you know, increase the worst case execution time of that by, you know, 10, 20%. There's an example there. With DDoS, that's not true. System tick is independent of system timing. It's only used as a synchronization method. It could be the major frame. It could be longer. It could be shorter. But the key is it's not the lowest resolution of timing that can be done in the system. Memory pools, cache partitioning. This is another unique patented architecture in DDoS that enables the application to just use the memory that it needs. It has multiple benefit. It allows the user to partition the cache memory, reduce interference patterns that applications might run into when they're using shared cache. It's been proven to greatly reduce the worst-case execution time in complex avionics systems. It also allows you, if you're using an SoC or something like that, you can take the on-chip memory and bind that to a specific cache partition and run really fast applications in that piece of memory. So it basically helps isolate and reduce analysis that has to be done for some of these DO-178C systems. It even helps in multi-core. It's very powerful because it will minimize some of those contention issues and helps you identify and isolate those. Find the right button here. So just in summary, I think from an RTOS vendor, these are the kinds of things you want. You want the pedigree. You want development environments. You want a reuse strategy that's usable across all your platforms, and an RTOS architecture that gives you unique capabilities that will enable you to be successful and to move forward in the future. So that is all I have. I'm going to turn it back over to John for the question and answer session.
Thank you very much, Gary. Excellent presentation by both our speakers. And now we'll get right to our Q&A. First question from the audience is, will DO-178C save me money or cost me money compared to DO-178B?
Oh, I take it that's for me.
Yeah, sorry for that, Vance. Yep.
That's a great question. The answer is it depends, but I think there's a very clear answer. For those people who are not doing modeling, formal methods, or OO, and who already have detailed requirements and good testing, I believe that 178C will save you a little bit of money, but perhaps more importantly, it's going to cost your competitors who aren't doing those things, aren't having good detailed requirements, good testing, it's going to cost them more money. Might make your life easier in an interesting way, huh? However, maybe for the majority of people, probably 60 or 70%, those folks that perhaps don't have real good CMI level 3 processes, don't have detailed requirements, don't do a good job of doing robustness testing tied to requirements to garner structural coverage, those folks, it's going to cost more. You'll definitely want to improve your processes to add more detailed requirements. Ensure those covered the configuration items, the parameter data items. Make sure that you have exceptionally good tests write those tests right up front before you actually write the code. Use those tests, the questions, the assumptions that have to be answered to write those tests, feed that back into the requirements process to improve those, then you will minimize the extra cost that most people will encounter with 178C. Remember, 178C wasn't made to save us money. It was made to save our lives. So big difference. That can cost money if we try to take shortcuts. That's my answer to that one.
Thank you, Vance. Next question is for Gary. Gary, did the tools provided, do the pools provided determine worst-case execution time affect the value reported?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the important thing to note is I talked a little bit about Slack scheduling, and all the DOS tools run in Slack time. So they never take up any of the timeline in the execution. So the worst case execution time is not affected by running any of our tools. The debugger as well as obviously if you're single stepping it would, but the worst case execution, the time map, and those kind of things. So you can get a true value of what your worst case execution time is.
Okay. Next question. Is the DO178C standard focused to reduce the customer escapes? Who would like to take that? Well, actually, it's assigned to Vance. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, John. Well, to reduce customer escapes, so shortcuts, let's say. Yes, indeed. 178C is actually a fairly modest change to 178B. The real change of 178C is in two areas. It's the implication of required ecosystem safety systems, 4761, 54A. And also those four new supplements for model-based development tools, OO, and four methods that don't apply only to software, but also hardware, IMA, et cetera, ground-based systems. So the changes to 178C, the focus of this question, really were meant to reduce those loopholes, those escapes, shortcuts, if you will, specifically weak low-level requirements, okay? Weak source-to-binary correlation for level A, objective number 70 and 71. And I would say the tool qualification shortcuts that were taken are also tightened via DO330. So those are the key areas that are really important, combined with parameter data items that we can't simply move off board and call them configuration items. We have to have requirements for them, traceability, reviews, and tests. So if people were taking shortcuts, and they were, then most folks are really shut down on that. So hopefully 178C goes a long way. But remember, it's not perfect. We still have these aspect of derived requirements and robustness testing and separation between high and low-level requirements that really wasn't clarified. So we're seeing today some shortcuts, some escapes still being taken there. Folks should really read the CAST papers and understand the true intent and also use good tools for verifying and testing to make sure that those are properly done. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Vance. Next question for Gary. Most RTOS vendors state they support software reuse. How is DOS different?
Well, I think, as I was talking a little bit in the slide set, is software reuse is not just a source code level thing. The way that DOS uses it is all the kernel, all the components of the kernel, the library, the drivers, every executable. They're all independent executables or shared libraries, and those modules can be loaded independently through a DALA linker that we provide in the system. Therefore, those binaries and the configuration files and artifacts that associate with them can truly move from platform to platform, process to process. And so it's very easy to reuse all of that information.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next question is for Vance. What are the benefits of having specification models?
Well, that's a good question. So 178C, and specifically DO331, give us flexibility. Remember, we can put a million lines of code in an assembly file without comments, and theoretically, be certified. That's not a good idea. But we can have five different flavors in the modeling ice cream store. One of those, a couple of those flavors actually have specification model explicitly called out. A specification model is a nice transform and has a benefit from going from an English system requirement to a high-level model. So think of it this way. 178 allows us, 178C and DO331 allow us to have just one model. We can have a spec model or a design model. However, by having both, then we have improved verification of the design model because we don't have to verify in a single step going from system requirement to the design model. The spec model has its own standard, so we improve the spec, the model, before we start implementing the design via the design model, which means before the code. So we minimize assumptions there. And if we use the same language between the spec model and design model, and we should, no point at all in switching languages. So you'd use the same language, for example, SysML to or UML, and use the same language for the spec model and the design model, then you will also eliminate the inconsistencies and assumptions there. The final advantage is if you have trained systems engineers who understand, speak, and write SysML or UML, those system engineers can transform or simply write the system requirements into the spec model. Now you've got the true benefit of having a single language shared between system engineers and software engineers, which frankly is the number one source of errors in avionics software, those different assumptions between systems and software. If you had a common language via that spec model, you'd really go a long way to implement best practices within 178C. So thank you for that question.
Next question is for Gary. What about dual-core processors? How are DO178C and DOS affected?
Well, I think that DOS has a specific strategy for how we plan to deal with dual-core processors in the future. Currently, the implementation is, with a single core, but we have a multi-core platform that we're developing that takes into account a lot of the features that I mentioned, where, the scheduling features, the cache partitioning, and that kind of thing. There's, the real interesting thing about, having a, let's say, SMP dual-core environment is that, up until recently with the CAS 32 paper, there really wasn't a lot of guidance. And we had gone through various ways that we felt like that should be done, and we've developed a lot of technology that we've proven out in our single-core technology that we know we can move to the dual-core platforms as well. And it has a lot to do with the things that were called out in CAS 32, the actual, how do you protect one processor's resource from the other? How do you manage the contention between these cores, between the memory bus, and that kind of stuff? And so the ideas that I put forward with cache partitioning, memory pooling, those are focused at how do you separate the resources in such a manner that they don't interfere, so that shared cache, for instance, in a multi-core environment is not, causing worst-case execution time to, to triple or quadruple, as has been seen in a lot of SMP-type environments. So we feel like that our multi-core strategy is key. We've actually even presented the technology to the working group that developed the CAS 32, the paper, and we got some very good response to what technology we developed and how to move that forward.
Okay, thank you, Gary. Next question is for you as well. How do we trust the simulation environment for timing analysis?
That's a good question, but in reality, simulators are not real hardware. So, there's a lot of steps in this DO178 process, and a lot of steps in developing software. So, simulators are very good for doing functional, does it work type testing. Is the code executing what I expected? When you want to get timing numbers, you typically are going to have to go to a real hardware or more of a, maybe a model that includes that timing information. But in the DOS world, the QAMU simulation environment that we provide is a virtual machine. So the code executes normally like it would in a real system. It's just that because it's running on a Windows environment, you're not getting the same level of timing that you would.
Okay. Next question is for Vance. The example 5 provides an option to develop models starting from system requirements until software development process. Can you provide details on this?
Oh, yes. That was the ice cream store slide. Let me go to what we call the ice cream 5 flavors. I like all flavors of ice cream. Let me push that slide. Okay, there it is. It's my slide number 12. So there we have the 5 flavors of ice cream, the 5 types of modeling that are prescribed and recommended within DL 331. The Indy 5, let's take a look at that. All these are different, these 5 flavors, not by the taste, but by the boundary, okay? The boundary between system, high level, low level, and design. In MB5, model-based option 5, we can see that the system's requirement is in the same level as the high-level requirement, okay? So in this case, we only have a 2-step transformation between system and the code, specifically the system in the HLR and the design model, including the low-level requirements, LLR. So it's nice because the system engineers and the software engineers share a common requirement called the high level or called the system. It's a single artifact that contains both. So from a modeling standpoint then, we don't have models for the system. We don't have models for the specification. We go straight to the design model. This is particularly well suited for a less than massive system, perhaps 10 to 50,000 lines of code that can be codified, captured within a design model. And then the way we evaluate the design model is not by comparing it to the spec model, because there is not a spec model. It's instead comparing it to the high-level requirements, the system-level aspects that are written in English at the higher level. And then we go straight to, hopefully, code generation. The advantage of having modeling is really to be able to automate the code generation. So if you wanted to ask me which of these flavors I liked, obviously I like the several flavors, not all, that allow for automated code generation because we have a design model. So when you choose modeling, it's best, unless you're really new to modeling, it's best to choose one of these flavors that has a design model so you can push a button, for example, IBM Rhapsody, SRL SCADE, push that button and get the code generated. So MB5 is a nice way to go for medium complexity systems and still afford the ability to generate code. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we have time for one more question. So it's for the last one up here is Vance. Why does DL178C mandate bottom-to-top traceability?
Oh, that's a good question. 178B implied it. Most people did it. And if you had a good trainer or read a good book on 178, hopefully you would have done that. Got a little smile there. But 178C mandates it because we really have to show that there's no extra code in the system. It's required. Each developer, each system must show that all the code in the executable, object code, has a reason to be there. And the reason is a trace to a requirement. So 178C eliminates that shortcut to say accidental code that I don't know why it's there, perhaps compiler options on a level A system or compiler generate code, perhaps runtime libraries that I don't know their pedigree, so I'm not going to test them. That's no longer allowed. The bottom-to-top traceability ties into top-to-bottom. Top-to-bottom, remember, is do all the requirements have an implementation? Okay, requirements trace top-to-bottom to implementation code. Bottom-to-top traceability, for the question just asked, is and does the code have a reason to be there? 170C mandates that you prove the reason. You're guilty until proven innocent. Every element of object code has to be proven to have a reason to be there, and that's why.
Thank you, Vance. And that brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after the ECAS with more information. I'd like to thank Vance Hilderman and Gary Gilliland for speaking today and DDCI and Vector Software for sponsoring the event. This eCast will be archived online and will be available for 1 year. It will be archived today, and there will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media eCast. Goodbye.